Just a warning before we start, this episode contains discussion of suicide. We'll list some of the support services available at the end of the episode, and they'll also be on the full story page. I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. $900 psychiatrist appointments, months-long wait times, choosing between paying bills or seeing your psychologist, all leading to confusion, frustration, despair. These were just some of the stories The Guardian heard when we asked our readers about Australia's mental health system. Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Associate Editor Lucy Clark about Australia's mental health crisis. It's Friday, the 23rd of April. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Lucy.
Hi, Gabs.
You're joining us from the other side of the microphone this week.
I am indeed.
So this week, The Guardian launched a series on the mental health crisis in Australia. Can you tell us, Lucy, why we did that?
Sure. Look, one of the biggest stories to come out of the pandemic is the mental health crisis that this country is facing. You know, about 5 million Australians have direct experience with mental ill health every year. And if you further calculate the suffering that mental distress brings to whole families, you'd have to say that there would not be an Australian untouched by this issue. Now, the pandemic, by all accounts, has only increased demand for mental health services and has added to the issues faced by individuals. And we knew that the mental health system was struggling beforehand, but things are in the process of getting a whole lot worse. It's overstretched at best, and some say broken.
And how did you even start? Like, where do you start on such a huge issue?
So the best place we thought to start was with a reader call out. I mean, we had an idea of what the issues were beforehand, of course. There have been many stories about how the mental health system is broken, but we wanted to get first-hand accounts from our readers about their interactions with the mental health system, not just from those suffering from mental health issues, but also health practitioners too. So, you know, it's difficult for so many health practitioners in the system dealing with the demand. And we received over 700 responses in a few days, which was extraordinary. Mm. You know, we had to shut it down early because we knew we couldn't go through them all and respond to them all, which was really important as well because we're dealing with really vulnerable people.
Mm. And was there anything, Lenore, that came out of this process that you didn't know or that perhaps surprised you in some way?
No, it didn't surprise me because we knew the system was broken. It just really underlined that the system was completely broken. And when there've been report after report after report about this, Royal Commission in Victoria and a Productivity Commission report, and it's all a bit stripped back of real human experience in reports. Mm. It's shocking numbers, but not human experience. And when you read the human experience, the human stories behind the crisis, it's overwhelming. It's just overwhelmingly terrible. And the system is just so bust. So what we found in some of the stories that readers shared with us was people were just telling us the same story over and over again that, you know, if they could find a bulk billing GP and if that GP gave them a mental health plan and if they could get into a psychologist or a psychiatrist or get the help they need, which is almost impossible because waiting lists are blown out and most people have shut their waiting lists. And if they could then afford it because the plans, the rebates almost never cover the cost, you know, the ifs and ifs and ifs and hurdles and hurdles and hurdles to get even the beginning of some kind of care that people need are almost insurmountable. And that's if you live in a city where there are services. It was story after story after story of desperate people whose needs were not being met by a system into which the government keeps pouring more and more and more money. So something is going terribly, terribly, catastrophically wrong.
One of the things that shocked me, I guess, was that a lot of people told us that not only did the system not help them, it also actively traumatized them further. And that was, you know, a lot of people said that the system made things worse for them. And I guess when you think about the ideal environment to treat someone in the middle of a very distressing mental health episode, it would have to be the opposite of an emergency section of a hospital, right?
Mm.
But, you know, it's a scary thing to me that a lot of people said that they're dropping out of the system of care because it doesn't help them and in many cases harmed them.
One of the themes that I noticed in the reporting this week was that people were saying they still had to pay, you know, that they were out of pocket. I think, Lucy, one person said she had to choose between paying for a psychiatrist or her bills.
Yeah, yeah. Look, that story was repeated. Cost was one of the most prominent themes to come out of the responses. One reader perfectly put it, you know, finding a good psychologist or psychiatrist who bulk bills and has appointments available is like hunting for unicorns while blindfolded. Another told us that she saw a psychiatrist for $900 for the first session and $500 for subsequent sessions. I mean, it is just incredible that, you know, the cost is such a barrier to people getting the help they desperately need.
So what happens if you can't afford $900 or even half that for a psychiatrist?
I guess you either figure it out yourself or you get so unwell that you present at emergency and you're hospitalised.
So is this the missing middle that we talk about?
That's what the missing middle is. Yeah. If you're mildly mentally ill, if you have a mild illness, then there are services for you. And if you have a very acute illness and you're hospitalised, then there are services for you, although they're also stretched. But if you're in the middle, which is most of the 1 in 5 Australians who have a mental illness in any given year, then you've got to navigate this incredibly opaque, overstretched, inadequate system.
Mm. And navigate is actually a word that I read over and over and over again. You know, people find it labyrinthine. You know, they cannot get through this system. They don't know where to go. It seems fragmented, incoherent. And this is where people get lost.
So when you say people don't know where to go, just to put that into very basic terms for people, you know, I know if I break my arm, I go to the emergency department. Or if I've got a cold or something that's not getting better, I go to my GP. What do people who have mental ill health do?
So in the first instance, they usually go to their GP. But you can't actually figure out even the starting point of someone's mental health in 15 minutes or even 30 minutes, you know, in a long appointment. So, okay, let's say you've got a GP who's got the time to talk to you and sees that you've got a problem, then they're going to write you a mental health plan. And then you have to go off and find yourself a psychologist or a psychiatrist, depending, well, a psychologist usually in the first instance. In most places, they're booked out. And anyway, you don't know where to start. So let's say you find one. The success of that psychologist-patient relationship depends on a good fit. So the first one you find might not be the right one for you. And you've only got a finite number of appointments and you probably had to wait 3-4 months to get an appointment, even if you can get one.
Mm.
And so let's say then that person really isn't the right fit. Then you're waiting another 4 months. And in the meantime, your mental illness has gotten worse, has gone untreated for all that time. If it's a psychiatrist you're after, it's more difficult, takes longer, harder to get in, vastly more expensive. So it's just impossible for people to navigate.
One woman wrote in to us, a mother who wanted to remain anonymous. And when her son was 12 years old, he was actively suicidal and in a highly distressed state. And they took him to hospital and they couldn't get him admitted after 5 hours. And so they left. And as he was walking out, he sent a text to a friend saying, "I'm still going to kill myself." Mm. And only when they could show the hospital that text was he admitted. That was 2 years ago. After that, they have been down many dead ends, tried, you know, shopfront mental health care services and different healthcare professionals. And now they're sort of left with seeing a prohibitively expensive psychiatrist once a week who the mother's not convinced about, the son doesn't talk to, but they're seeing him just for the sake of continuation of something. And it's inadequate for them. It's not working. They don't feel it's useful for anything other than tweaking medication. But for the sake of continuing some sort of care for that child, they're sticking with it.
So, as you said before, Lenore, we've had inquiries into this. We knew that there was a problem. How do we change the conversation? What has to happen now?
I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but it feels to me like we really need to rethink the whole thing. Now, I don't understand why we couldn't have a psychologist or a psychiatrist attached to most big GP clinics, so that if you did go and see a GP and the GP thought that there was a mental illness occurring or brewing, that they could say, well, you can go and see this person attached to our surgery, so that it's more integrated in your general healthcare rather than being sent off to sort of find a needle in a haystack with no guidance about how you do that, having some sort of pathway to getting what you need. I think that there needs to be a lot more investment in that middle part, in getting people enough appointments and with enough of a rebate that they can see the people and get the help that they need. I think there probably needs to be more investment at the acute care end as well. And I think a really, really big missing link is care for children.
Yeah, this did seem to come up a lot in the things that I read this week, Lucy. What's the big problem there? One of the biggest problems
there? Well, early intervention is so important and missing, I think, a lot of the time. You know, we know that the onset of mental health issues is happening earlier. I mean, one statistic that stands out for me from someone I interviewed ages ago was that, you know, 40 years ago, the average age of onset of a mental health issue was 28, and now it's the age of 14.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, there's something terribly wrong going on for our kids.
And yet a lot of services that those 14-year-olds need aren't available until they're 16. So a lot of the acute care services, a lot of the things that should be available for younger children who are mentally ill are not available until they're 16.
I mean, ultimately, prevention is better than cure with all illness, right? And I think we need to shift our perceptions of mental illness and see it as part of a bigger, much bigger societal picture in which too many people live in poverty, too many people are homeless. And, you know, these are direct social drivers of mental health issues in many cases. You know, Karen Price, who's from the Royal Australian College of GPs, said to think we can just approach mental illness from the disease end is ridiculous.
So what you're saying is when we talk about mental health, often there's a lot of focus on hospital beds, putting more money into hospitals to treat people.
Yeah, acute
and she's
care.
Saying, not, let's not do that.
Well, obviously we have to do that as well, but it's a slight shift in thinking of seeing the bigger picture and knowing that so many people are living in circumstances that are essentially incompatible with good mental health. And in many cases, there are things that with some sort of political will could be fixed. So if you take one thing like public housing, for example, you fix that and fix homelessness, a significant percentage of mental health issues in the community would be fixed.
But then when you look at the mental health among children and adolescents, there's a whole lot of factors there that are much harder to fix, like the stresses of being young at the moment and the stresses of the pandemic and fear about the future, about climate change, about whether that, you know, there's a whole lot of quite legitimate and rational fears and stresses that all combine to make life overwhelming for young people oftentimes.
Yes, in many ways anxiety is the rational response to these challenges that these kids are facing.
So these seem like really big problems to solve. Is there political will, Lenore?
Scott Morrison has said that it's a priority for him, and the government has announced a number of policy interventions and an amount of spending, and apparently there'll be more in the budget. I guess my concern or my fear is that we're layering things on top of the current system, which in my view isn't working. And it sort of feels like we need to sit down and reconfigure it and change it fundamentally. So actually on this issue, I do think there's political will on both sides of the fence, but I'm not sure that there is enough hard work being done to pull it apart and build it back in a better way.
Because, you know, throwing more money at the same things that clearly aren't working doesn't seem to be the best solution at this point. Actually, our medical editor, Melissa Davey, has a really interesting piece coming out tomorrow in which she interviews Professor Ian Hickey, who's the former National Mental Health Commissioner. And he says that we need evaluation of existing services and some actual data about whether they work before we refine what reform is needed.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place to start. Look out for that at theguardian.com on Saturday by Melissa Davey. Next, what does a milkshake have to do with consent? And the Big Bird Bandits. So this brings us to what we could not get out of our head this week. Lenore, what could you not get out of your head?
I cannot stop thinking about that ridiculous consent video involving milkshakes.
Do you want to try my milkshake?
Yes, I do.
Partly because as many times as I've watched it, I still don't understand what they're trying
Me
to
neither.
Say. Like, I just don't get it.
Well, drink it. Drink it all.
What are you doing?
Drink it all.
I kept trying to figure out who was what and what was the ice cream. I don't know. So, you know, if I don't know, I'm not sure that the children who were the alleged audience would know. And the thing that I really can't get out of my head is if that was the answer that the creatives came up with, what was the brief? Like, what were they asked to do?
I would love to see that brief.
Yeah,
anyway,
I was surprised when I heard it was for 15 to 18-year-olds.
If anyone has the brief,
as well.
Please send it in. We really want to see it.
And Lucy, what was your...
Well, I also couldn't get the milkshake consent video story out of my head. But to get it out of my head, I focused very heavily on the Big Bird Bandit story from Adelaide. Apparently two bandits stole a Big Bird costume from a circus and they signed a note, the Big Bird Bandits, saying, "We are so sorry, we had no idea what we were doing." And the thing I really couldn't get out of my head, that the Big Bird costume was worth $160,000.
Apparently it had been flown in from New York.
Yes. Well, I think it might be the Big Bird suit.
Is it bad for me to say I hope the bandits had fun with it?
They definitely
I think they
have
did
fun.
Say they
yeah,
had fun.
Yeah.
And I hope they haven't posted any selfies.
They actually said, "We had a great time with Mr. Bird. He's a great guy and no harm came to our friend."
Oh, yeah, they did say it was returned in very good condition.
Yes.
So I think there is a happy end to the story.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us and having such a difficult discussion.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks, Gabs.
In Australia, the Crisis Support Service Lifeline is on 13 11 14 and Beyond Blue can be reached at 1300 22 4636. Other international helplines can be found at www.befrienders.org. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater, Laura Murphy-Oates and Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great weekend. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.